Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Quick, think of one of your favorite memes that you like to use, or maybe just the most popular ones you've seen on social media. Chances are pretty good that they were created or influenced by Black culture. That's one of the arguments that cultural commentator Lauren Michelle Jackson makes in her book, White Negroes, When Cornrows Were in Vogue, and Other Thoughts on Cultural Appropriation. Lauren hopes that the book inspires a public conversation about the co-opting and consumption of Black culture.
I think the way that appropriation gets talked about in the sort of public discourse of it all hasn't been the best and hasn't been really the most precise. So the first line of my book is that appropriation gets a bad rap. And I truly believe that when you sort of look at just the definition of appropriation and really isolate that word, you know, appropriation isn't in and of itself a negative thing. And one of the examples I use is hip hop culture and rap music, which is one of these really beautiful and glorious and really multidimensional genres of music that was able to happen through the confluence of a lot of different cultural influences. So not just Black American culture, as we would call it, but Southern Black American culture, East Coast culture, West Coast culture, culture from the islands, as well as the influence of Latino immigrants on the cross-cultural form and style and presence of that form. And so that kind of appropriation, we don't really even call appropriation because we like it, right? Whereas the forms of appropriation that have the sort of negative stigma attached to them, it's not because it's appropriation, it's because of a disparity in power that we're perceiving when we see somebody like Miley Cyrus, right, getting called edgy because she's doing this thing that Black women have been doing for ages and not getting called edgy or avant-garde or daring or risky, right? They have much more negative characteristics that get attached to Black people when they own their own culture.
Mm-hmm. You explore the career of pop star Christina Aguilera. How does she fit into the history of cultural appropriation?
I thought Christina Aguilera was a really interesting case, and she's sort of the figure that I use for pop music. What I think is really interesting about her is we have someone who is sort of raised on and like comes up through and adopts her vocal style through listening to R&B and funk and sort of old Black pop legends. And so this is someone who didn't just decide to adopt, say, a Black musical sound midway through her career. No, this is someone who is on the Mickey Mouse Club, you know, singing Whitney, singing Toni Braxton, right? But then we have this really interesting moment in the late 90s and early 2000s where sort of in concert with her trying to develop as an artist who is not a teen pop sensation anymore, but is a young woman and trying to take ownership of her image, is using a different kind of Black sound to sort of escalate her own, you know, sort of adolescence, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm. One of the Christina Aguilera songs that you talk about in your book is her 2006 single, Ain't No Other Man. Give us your take on this song.
You know, this is very much like the post Dirty period of her career where she is cleaning up, as like a lot of the journalists and music journalists were saying at the time. So she was eschewing the dark, dark tan and the dark, dark hair. She was back to blonde, bouncy curls, red lipstick, really, really playing up this sort of quasi-40s visual aesthetic. And then you have that first single, Ain't No Other Man, which again also has like the sort of 40s vibe, but there's also sort of a 20s vibe. And the video is a sort of mixture of all these old-timey American aesthetics combined with an actual sound that makes use of some 80 samples, 60 samples. You know, it dips into a lot of other different musical sounds as well. And so what I find very interesting about that song is that it's meant to evoke the jazz singers. It's meant to invoke a very a specific sort of classic, quote-unquote classic American sound that ultimately still ends up being very Black. And elsewhere on that album, she sings tributes to Aretha, to Patti, to, you know, the sort of very classic Black soul singers. But, you know, she gets to sort of make this transition where it feels like she completed, you know, whatever she was trying to work through with the sort of quote-unquote dirty hip-hop era. You know, now she gets to be the mature vocalist on the other side, and it's kind of like her transformation is complete, and you really see that with the success and the sort of critical acclaim of a song like Ain't No Other Man.
You have this fascinating chapter about memes, and you make the case that Black people are really driving meme culture. How are they doing that?
I think there's like the most like literal interpretation of that, which is that so many memes owe a debt to a certain kind of like Black vernacular to like articulate themselves. So that's sort of like the literal interpretation, and this is an observation I made like years and years and years ago about how much Black vernacular is like seeping into these memes who are being used by really people like all over the world, people of varying cultural backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, racial backgrounds.
Can you give me an example?
Do you remember like the Kermit sipping tea meme? So the reason why the meme was funny and initially came with this tagline, but that's none of my business or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, you go to church on Sunday, but be in the club on Friday night, but that's none of my business, or something like that, right? It's like supposed to be revealing like the hypocrisy of the statement. And then you have Kermit from this Lipton commercial sipping tea, which also has a sort of double, an additional valence to it, because, you know, when you sip tea, you know, that's from sort of queer vernacular, particularly from, you know, queer folks of color, meaning to sort of divulge or sort of like shadily divulge secrets and gossip, right?
Mm-hmm.
That meme struck me as like very, very Black, right? But it was not, you know, by no means limited to Black people. And it became very mobile in the sense that now you don't even need that macro text to like convey the sort of sensibility of the meme. You know, you can just have an emoji of a steaming teacup or coffee cup.
Yeah.
Or you could just have the little green frog in the coffee cup, and it sort of translates what the sense of that meme. That's like one example. But like the sort of more abstract and sort of more provocative part of the argument really is that the way that memes circulate and change themselves and sort of reinvent owes such a debt to the way that Black people move and change and reinvent culture. Memes are one form of expression that know that they're sort of subject to be tired out, and so they always have to sort of adapt and change and move. And in the same way that Black culture is so ripe to be taken mainstream and people get sick of it, you know, Black culture also reinvents itself as a means of survival. And so I think in my sort of like abstracty linguisticy argument, that's why I say that memes are super, super Black, you know, formally Black, not just linguistically and not just syntactically.
You say that memes latch onto Black cultural modes of improvisation. Can you explain how they do this?
So you can have memes that will combine themselves or be combined, because, you know, these are people making these things, right?
Yeah.
That will be combined with other memes, and like that becomes another meme and sort of gives life to these two other memes that were like being tired out. You'll see memes sort of cross forms, right? So thinking about the Kermit meme, where, you know, it used to be this image with the macro text, but now can be signified by an emoji or a hashtag, but that's none of my business, you know? So moving from a visual form to a textual form to an emoji form, just all these different ways of being refreshed in new ways that, you know, still have resonance with the old. And so I think about the Nina Simone refrain, which a scholar by the name of Geneva Smitherman talks about as having this really sort of Black tone to it, because she says, you know, it bees that way sometimes, which is like a phrase that still exists today in Black vernacular, even as it presents itself in other ways. Like, it just be like that sometimes. You know, we don't necessarily place emphasis on the bees, right? So be that way sometimes. You know, I see that sort of form of cultural survivor, and I see similarities with the way that memes exist and survive as well. And so that's how I say, you know, it's almost like Black vernacular taught memes how to change themselves and how to stay relevant within this really rapidly circulating atmosphere, you know, called online life, called the internet.
Lauren Michelle Jackson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lauren Michelle Jackson teaches at Northwestern University. She's the author of White Negroes, When Cornrows Were in Vogue, and Other Thoughts on Cultural Appropriation. Find out more about Lauren at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Peter Melman, Warren Zanes, and Lauren Michelle Jackson. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to Roz Grier.
She's real. She can bring home the bacon and fry it in the pan.
Slam that voice!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I once told a woman that I coined the phrase, pardon my French.
Our executive producer, nay, showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
Oh, how could he be so vain?
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
I am loving this yada yada thing. You know, I can gloss over my whole life story.